Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. A couple of weeks ago, the WHO launched the Malaysian chapter of the Global Plan for the Decade of Action for Road Safety for the year 2021 till 2030. Now, the explicit target of that plan is to reduce the number of road deaths and injuries by at least 50% over the next decade. Now, some grim statistics about Malaysia's road safety. Malaysia has the third highest road traffic mortality rate in the Western Pacific region. And for every 10 road deaths that happened in Malaysia this year, 7 were motorcycle users. And that means that we are now a close second to Thailand as having the world's worst death rate for motorcyclists. Also, road traffic injury accounts for 14% of deaths among children aged 5 to 14 years. And that makes it the leading cause of child mortality in the country. What needs to be done to reduce and prevent the number of road deaths and injuries that we see from happening? So let's ask our first guest tonight, Professor Dr. Kulanthayan Mani. He's an executive director of Safe Kids Malaysia, which is with the Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences at University Putra Malaysia. Safe Kids aims to improve the lives of children through injury prevention. Dr. Kulan, good evening. Thank you for being with us tonight. Let's start with the grim ranking that Malaysia has taken in the Western Pacific region with the third highest mortality for a road traffic death. So I'm just wondering, were you as surprised by this as many in the public might be?
Thanks to Astro Awani for inviting us for this session. Yeah, if we look at the indicators, there are two types of indicators. One is when you're comparing between countries. What I'm more concerned is when we are comparing within the country by the years. So if we look in Malaysia, if you see, until 2016, we had a rise in number of crashes and fatalities. But starting 2017 onwards, even though we had rise in number of crashes, but our number of fatalities has started to go down. From 17 until 2020, we have been showing an absolute number of reduction in terms of fatality. So what we can conclude from here is, in terms of crash prevention program, it is not giving us much return, but injury prevention programs are giving us return. So this is an area where we should be focusing. Okay, that's one in terms of injury prevention to further continue. But at the same time, we should start to relook back. Why aren't we getting a reduction in terms of number of crashes? So those programs which we can reduce number of crashes have to be emphasized in this new decade. And at the same time, we have to reinforce whatever programs which have been giving us reduction in terms of number of deaths and serious injuries.
Kulan, how long has this state of affairs been? I mean, did we suddenly spring into the top three positions in terms of mortality and injuries and all these other, yardsticks? Or is that something that's been longstanding, one that, has been perhaps ignored by policymakers for the last couple of decades?
Yeah, in terms of ranking, the ranking will change because it is not only depend on how we perform, but it's also depend on how the other countries perform. So rankings can change, but then generally we are on the high end as well. Not only Malaysia, any countries which has high number of motorcycle population will generally record high number of fatalities. The reason is because motorcycle, if you see, is an exposed vehicle. So in a crash, when it happens, is you get the direct impact. Compared to if you're sitting inside a car, you have one layer of protection. So any countries which has high number of motorcycles or in terms of motorcycles and private vehicle usage will record generally high number of crashes and fatalities. Right. One. Second is that in terms of public transport usage, we are a bit more low. For those countries who are doing well globally, if you see, they have invested pretty much well in terms of public transport. And in public transport, they have invested more on the rail-based public transport because that is one of the more safest mode of transport.
Dr. Kulani, can I come back to what you said about programs that reduce the number of crashes versus programs that may prevent injury? Can you explain what are the difference? I mean, how do you target a reduction in number of crashes? And I'm guessing the severity of the crash would also mean, you know, reducing injuries and fatalities. What specifically goes into the design of that program?
Okay, let me start in terms of injury prevention programs, because we have seen some reduction since 2017 until 2020. Injury reduction programs are something like, say, usage of seat belts, usage of motorcycle safety helmet. These two interventions will not have any effect in terms of reduction in terms of crashes. But once a crash happens, then to reduce the injury severity is when these safety products will help us. So if you go along that line, motorcycle helmet usage is there. It is giving us results. But one area which we are lacking is in terms of children using a standard motorcycle safety helmet. So that is a gap that we need to close in this decade. That's one. Seatbelt usage is giving us reduction, but it's being used by the driver and the front seat passenger. What is lacking, or the gap that need to be addressed, is the rear passengers. They have to use rear seatbelt as well. Two. The third one we see is in terms of child who are traveling in the car. A child, for their safety protection, they need to use a child restraint seat. And that law has just been approved in this country. And we are hoping that it will be enforced soon. So while waiting for it to be enforced, we are requesting with every parent to make sure that do provide a child restraint seat for your child in order to make sure that your child travels safely in the car.
Dr. Glenn, I think many of us have seen children, you know, sandwiched between their parents on a motorbike or clinging to their parents, you know, as they're being transported to school. Is it a question of class and of the affordability of these things, of the presumptions we make that families are small and therefore, you know, you can seat two children in the back, so on and so forth? Is there a socioeconomic dimension that needs to be addressed here?
Yeah, you're right. Socio-academic dimension has to be addressed. That's one. But at the same time, we also have to look at a mobility issue as well. Say a family with say four people in the family, again, and they only have one mode of transport, which is motorcycle. But what we're trying to tell the parents is, as much as important you want to transport your child and your family members, do give equal importance also for the safe travel. What we're emphasizing is you have to provide a safe travel for your child or any family members who are traveling. That's one. So understanding the mobility issue here is, if the government can invest heavily on public transport, then to a certain extent, we can handle this mobility issue.
That's a good point. Now, coming to that question of whose responsibility is it? So the government, perhaps more investment in public transport, but you know, sometimes when we talk about road safety, it almost always boils down to the behavior of the road user. And when you talk about, you know, reckless driving or parents not putting helmets on their young children, what can we then, how do we change that behavior through policy? Is that through legislation? Have we seen policy work in changing behavior, or is it just about education and awareness?
Yeah, I would say road safety is everyone's responsibility, not only with the government. And to make changes happen, of course, government can do it through legislation change. But that only is not enough, because we as the road user who will be using the system also have to change our behavior. And once we start changing our behavior from an unsafe behavior towards safe behavior and keep on practicing that safe behavior, that will become a culture. That's one. Second is, we should change our culture of using any safety product or complying any traffic regulation just for the reason to avoid a traffic summon. Example, say we are reducing the speed, it's not because we believe it will make us safe, but because we want to avoid a traffic summon. So that culture has to change. That start using safety product because you believe in that safety product. So along that line, I would recommend everyone, for those who have children who are using bicycles, even though we don't have a bicycle helmet law, but we don't have to wait for one. If we believe a bicycle helmet can prevent head injuries and brain injuries, then why not start using one for the safety of our child? That's one. Second, yeah, similarly goes on the child restraint seat.
Absolutely. I understand what you're saying. Very quick questions, because we're running out of time, which is, the responsibility in terms of road design, because, you know, we do read of motorcyclists dying from potholes. And potholes are not about a question of a personal responsibility. It's about the failure of municipal councils or, you know, or the, you know, Jabatan Kerjaraya, whatever it is, to make roads safe. In your work, do you think there is a deficit on that end of the equation when it comes to road safety?
Yes, you're right. For every crash that happens, there are multiple reasons. And one reason is what you have mentioned as well. We need to provide a safe road infrastructure. That has to be there in order to make sure that we also have safe road users as well as safe vehicles. So this, the infrastructure has to be there, the vehicles has to be safe, and not to forget, the road user also has to be a safe road user in order for us to get a complete safety benefit from this road network.
Right. Thank you so much, Professor Kulantayan Kesimani there from Safe Kids Malaysia. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more on this issue of transport safety. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're watching Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me is Sharad Kutin. And if you've just joined us on the show, we're discussing Malaysia's track record on road safety. This after the WHO urged Malaysia to get serious about road safety, as we are now the third highest traffic death rate in the West Pacific region. Let's speak now to Transport Planner 1, Agil Wan Hassan. Agil, let's look at the burden of road safety. It's often placed on the road users. I mean, accidents, injuries and death are often blamed onto the drivers. I'm wondering how much of that burden falls onto the state in terms of the government. What is the government's role in ensuring road safety, either through infrastructure design or through maintenance?
Thank you, Melissa and Sharad. I think the most important part of this road safety issue is the government commitment. One thing that very clear we can see today is that government really lack of commitment to resolve the road safety issue. The recent budget announcement, you can see there is no budget allocated for road safety issue, especially on building infrastructure for our motorcyclists. As we know that most of the road accidents involve motorcyclists, and we can see, based on the statistic, 7 out of 10 accidents involve motorcyclists. This is a huge calling to the government. While we are focusing on education, health, we forgot that there is a need for us to address this issue before it becomes really worse. We lost a lot of life due to these motorcycle accidents, and nothing has been done. Our road development didn't really consider even building motorcycle lanes, for example. So we totally forgot about our motorcyclists in this country, and their numbers are growing every year. I think this is the most difficult part. That I'm trying to understand why government are very not concerned over the commitment to resolve the road safety issue, especially involving motorcyclists.
Well, Agil, I mean, I challenge you to name a single member of parliament who rides a motorbike to parliament or to work. I mean, the ruling class does not travel on two wheels. And that may be a simple, perhaps naive response to your question. Why don't they care? But I do want to ask you about other contexts, maybe, where they have addressed the issue, where there are, as our first guest had mentioned, countries where there is a lot of motorcycle use have high numbers in terms of mortality or injuries. So are there things that have been put in place that we can learn from? We don't have to reinvent the wheel. Perhaps we need to get the money, but we don't have to reinvent the wheel in terms of best practices. What are you seeing around the world?
Well, I think if you want to compare with other countries, Malaysia has the most efficient solution when it comes to motorcycle issues. I think we are the only country that has the motorcycle lanes at the early stage. And this is the best example that we don't have to look at other countries. I mean, the motorcycle lanes introduced in this country is the one and only done by most of the governments, right? But the problem is we built it, and then we forgot to extend it. Because every year we build more roads, but we forgot to build more motorcycle lanes. That's number one. Number two, we forgot to maintain motorcycle lanes. We have a lot of accidents involve motorcycle in the motorcycle lanes. This involves potholes and everything. But I think one of the areas that we might want to consider is regarding kapchai or underbone motorcycles that below 250 cc's. Most of the accidents involve this type of motorcycles. We have about 11 million active kapchai or underbone motorcycles in the country. And if you look into the statistic, in 12 years, about 4,100 kapchai's user died because of the accidents. So do we still want to have this kind of motorcycles on the road? Because this kind of motorcycles is very light, very easy to handle, and it can be 6 years old, 7 years old kids can ride these kind of motorcycles in the rural area, going to schools, going to shops, buying groceries. But we still need to think whether or not we want to maintain this type of motorcycle or slowly phasing it out and replace it to a lower CC.
I take your point, and I think it's a really good suggestion. I'm just wondering, is it a politically unpopular decision if the government makes this legislation?
Possibly, because we can see huge numbers of people decided to buy or maybe justifying their purchase on this kind of motorcycles because of cost. Average cost of kapchai motorcycle can be around 3,000 to 4,000. But let's understand the options. If we look into electric motorcycle, for example, it can cost you between 1,500 to 2,000 ringgit. It's more cheaper than the kapchai motorcycles. And it's not as fast as the kapchai motorcycle that people can easily modify and turn it to become a killing machine. This is a killing machine that we didn't realize. So it's not gun, it's not knife. In Malaysia, kapchai and underbone is the killing machine that caused a lot of death. And this is a loss of productivity to the country. And if you look into the MIRA study, I mean, economically, we lost about 18.15 billion between 2015 to 2017 alone. This is a huge loss to the country. Can we afford that kind of productivity loss? And not thinking about maybe phasing out kapchai motorcycle altogether, perhaps gradually. Right. I think that's the biggest question that needs to be answered by politicians.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. I appreciate your insights. Transport planner Wan Agil Wan Hassan there. We're going to take another quick break. Stay tuned to Consider This. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Shraddha and I on Consider This. Let's continue our conversation about road safety in Malaysia with Dr. Ahmad Azad Abdul Rashid. He's the Chief Research Officer at the Malaysian Institute for Road Safety Research, or better known as MIROS. Azad, a couple of weeks ago, the WHO launched this, you know, the Malaysian chapter for the Global Plan for the Decade of Action for Road Safety, ambitious targets to reduce road deaths and injuries by 50% in the next decades. And I'm just wondering, how do these types of long-term, big-picture plans translate into policy and into action?
Okay. First of all, thank you for having me. The WHO has launched the global plan that you mentioned, the United Nations has urged and put forward that most of the ask for countries around the world to stick to use the plan as a guide and then work on their plan. So in Malaysia, in terms of policy, we have been working on our version of road safety plan. It's our third plan. Even before the launch of the global plan, that plan is being championed by Ministry of Transport with strategic partners and stakeholders. We are working on trying to see what we can learn from the previous two plans and trying to make a better strategic direction from what we have.
So, Dr. Azad, I mean, so this is good news that the minister, the ministry is aware, and the institutions, respective authorities are aware of these, the need for a blueprint or a plan. But then how? What accounts for the appalling statistics? I mean, if government is so keenly aware of the problem, why haven't plans translated into reductions in numbers of deaths and injuries and lessening of headlines where we read people dying because they're potholes? I mean, where's the gap between these two facts, as it were?
Yeah. As we know, even from the global plan itself, it emphasized on the approach of systemic, safe system approach, which means that everyone has to play their role. Yeah. So while we are busy looking at the problem at this high level, macro level, I think road safety is actually closer to us and then what we might have thought. Yeah. Nowadays, everyone is a road user. So to make an make a difference, it is doable even at our own personal level. We can go back to the basic, for example, of the helmet wearing, the seat belt, fighting the urge to speed, practice good manners, like giving signals, etc. Well, having said that, however, we have to be mindful that we should not put a sole responsibility only on human error, because history has shown us that this traditional approach didn't work. I mean, so that's why we can see the shift from that approach of blaming just road users to safe system approach. And that takes everyone to come on board and make it work.
Okay, all right. Well, so part of Miros's remit is to look into road users' behavior and to tailor programs to I guess, change that behavior, influence that behavior for better road safety. I'm just wondering, because we spoke to to Professor Cullen a little bit earlier in the show, and he talked about, you know, crash preventative programs and injury preventative programs. And I'm just wondering what Miros has done, or what data Miros has gathered about this. I mean, what can be done to change the behavior of some road users, not blaming it on error or errant driving, but changing behavior so we're all kind of collectively invested in road safety?
Yeah, when we're talking about road user behavior, the evidence we have shown that a quick fix is through enforcement. Enforcement works. But enforcement is costly, yeah, and it's not sustainable. So the other component is education. So research has shown that if we couple both the enforcement and also education together, we can have the effectiveness effect twice than we just focusing on education. But having said that, we need to invest in education, because that's the long term, that the sustainability part. We have to move from having this quick fix into something that is a long-term fix. So education can help us in that.
So very quickly, we have a little bit of time left. We were also told that there was no specific allocation for road safety in the latest budget. Where is the money coming from? Is government putting its money where its mouth is, as it were?
Oh, that's a very big question. When we talk about road safety, of course, there are dedicated specific projects that we will be very grateful if we have that. Yeah, but we have to understand that even without a dedicated budget, we can make a difference. Yeah, by putting all this integrated approach. For example, we see that 70% of motorcyclists among the labor forces in Malaysia, which means those are employees of certain companies. So by taking the route, the employer playing a bigger role, for example, putting more emphasis, more role, active responsibility, we can make a difference in that channel as well.
Okay, thank you so much. Ahmad Azad. Abdul Rashid there.
You're
from
welcome.
Miros, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. Don't forget to get the latest COVID-19 vaccine information on our website, astroawani.com, as well as the Astro Awani app. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching. Good night.